As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Pressure than hoe, riddle me that. The rest of y'all know where I'm lurking, yeah. Can none of y'all mirror me back? Yeah, hear me rap, it's like Angie rapping his prime. I'm young H.O.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Miami Nice. I'm your co-host, Blake Howard. Joining me as always is my awesome co-host. She's a fiend for mojitos. It's Katie Walsh, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello, we have emerged once again to record another Miami Nice with arguably like a titan of the Miami Nice fandom. The Miami Vice fandom, excuse me.
He is both a Miami Nice fan because of he is a Miami Vice fan. No, he's, I mean, as a person who did one Heat Minute and has done last 12 minutes of the Mohicans and has been obsessed with Michael Mann, there is one other human being on the planet that is like, if you do not have an answer about the Michael Mann fandom, you defer to this man. He's the 3-star general of all Michael Mann obsession. He's one of my favorite people in the entire universe. He is really going a long way to stoke the fires of the Black Hat fandom in every way possible, which is both hilarious and infuriating at the same time based on the amount of interactions I have. It's the great and wonderful Bill Gabbieri, mate. Thank you so much for coming in podcasting with me. And now Katie about Miami Vice.
Yay.
This is very exciting. I'm very happy to be here.
Katie, I think, brought up just before we started your favorite hot take, which causes a lot of sort of spicy reactions, is that the director's cut, or as Michael Mann calls it in the director's commentary, my current preference cut of this movie is to begin it with the boat race and add a couple of other scenes and change some music cues. But your version of Miami Vice, in preference is the director's cut. And Katie and I are on record on Miami Nice saying that the theatrical cut is absolutely our jam. Can you talk to us about first that little spicy hot take and then why Miami Vice? Because I've gotten to talk to you a little bit about it before, but I think never in just a dedicated smorgasbord of your opinions about this movie.
In terms of the cuts, my take is not that the director's cut is superior. I'll get into this in a second, but the theatrical cut is very, very special to me. My take is that what I would love to see is an intermediate cut, which is basically the opening of the theatrical cut, which is essential.
Yes.
As beautiful as that boat race is, the cold open or the hard open of the theatrical cut is, for me personally, a very important moment in my life. But that hard open in the club and then the rest of the director's cut, that is my preferred cut. I think the director's cut, because it, it gives us more of Trudy. It works that storyline, and it has one of my favorite scenes or my favorite threads, which is the flowers, salutations from your friends in the South. I think that's just a beautiful, haunting moment that really makes the rest of the film richer and much more suspenseful. And also I think establishes certain themes or clarifies certain themes. And, you know, I don't want to lose that. and I think, you know, there's little nips and tucks that make the director's cut, you know, the rest of the director's cut a little clearer. And I also, as much as I don't think it should have been a cover of
In the Air Tonight, non-points yeah, cover of In the Air Tonight.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, and I don't know, I've never asked Michael, I mean, maybe you guys know, I've never asked him why it's a cover and not the original. It's in, you know, at first I thought, oh, it's probably some rights thing. And then I thought, no, you know, this Michael Mann, he is famous for overcorrecting. And it's entirely possible that he just thought this was a much more muscular, modern sound to have this like blaring hard rock cover of In the Air Tonight. And every time I watch the director's cut, of course, I'm like, God, imagine if Phil Collins was playing over this moment, how beautiful this would be.
So what I think you're saying is the intermediate cut, which I think Katie and I are also huge fans of. We're on record talking about that Trudy scene many times.
Yeah.
Yes, I think every single episode of this podcast, we managed to talk about the flowers, also talk about the soundtrack. You've hit like every single
And the cold open.
The movie is romance. The movie is romance, menace, and music.
Yes,
so that's what it is.
But yeah, we've also I think like landed on like there needs to be the intermediate cut because we love the Numb Encore open, obviously, and you know the boat race is beautiful, but it should have just been like a trailer or something. We love the Trudy scene and the flowers. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It should have been the closing credits. But, yes. bring back Isaac de Bancole.
But if any editors are listening, could we just get that to happen and also then put the Phil Collins in the air tonight over the top? If you could just overlay that with the Phil Collins, sublime.
There are people who will do this.
Release the Abiri cut. Release the Abiri cut.
The Abiri cut. No, do you guys know Racer Trash? They do the vaporwave cuts. It's like this collective of editors, and they stream them on Twitch, and it's like they'll do like a vaporwave Clueless. They'll do vaporwave. Like they did a Heat. The Heat one was mind boggling. Like,
oh my God.
You just need to like get some devil's lettuce and settle in for a Razor Trash moment, but they need to do this one. I need to tweet at them to do this one. 100%. And they'll do the Phil Collins and it'll just be like a mind melter.
Oh my God. I think it would be such a different scene. But Birga, let's go back because you talked about the opening cut of Miami Vice, that hard open, as you said, being like a bit of a life changer for you. And I know that we need to explain and tease this out for Katie because I'm someone who's actually heard that you weren't such a huge fan of Michael Mann's stuff, but this moment, this film was kind of a gateway to an entire reappraisal of his work.
Yeah, and I don't want to overstate it. I liked Michael Mann's films. I had seen Last of the Mohicans opening day in New York. I loved it. I had seen Heat opening night in New York. So I was always... on board, right? You know, I was with the program. I loved The Insider. I hated Ali, which I now love, one of my favorite movies by him. You know, and Collateral, I was mixed on. There were certain elements of it I loved. But, and we've talked about this too, and I've written about this, but even Heat, when I first saw it, I thought, well, some of this is great. And then some of it is not so great. And some of it is, he's overreaching a little bit. I mean, I wasn't entirely... Or I was partly on board with many of the critical, knocks on Heat, which was he's trying too hard. You know, he's not he's going for this Dickensian thing. He's losing the thread of the awesome cops and robbers movie, which, of course, you know, since then, I have since discovered that these are actually the things that make Heat special and not just another fucking cop movie. But you know, Michael Mann was somebody I kind of held at a certain distance because I was like, there's certain things about this guy that don't seem right to me as a filmmaker. Like he's always kind of missing, you know, he's always missing the mark a little bit, or often missing the mark a little bit just because he's maybe overreaching or he seems interested in things that I as the viewer am maybe not as interested in. And then I went to see the, it was the all media critics screening of Miami Vice. And I mean, the fucking thing just started. And I was like, oh, like, oh, wait, we're in the movie. Like, the movie has started. And
Linkin Park is blaring at me.
Yeah, right?
And I like it.
And the thing just, like, sucked me in. It absolutely sucked me in. And I totally lost myself inside the movie. And there were elements of the plot that I wasn't entirely clear on. There were lines of dialogue I didn't understand. But at the same time, I was so pulled into it. And I felt like I was there the whole movie, you know, 2 inches away from everybody's face. And I was like in the shower with them. I was on the boat with them. I was, you know, at the bar with them. I was like, you know, they were dancing.
You were salsa dancing with them.
Yeah, they were dancing and there was no room for Jesus, but somehow there was room for me, you know? Like, I mean, you just get pulled into this thing. And I watched that movie and I thought, oh, I get it now. I get it. I get what Michael Mann is about. And this is, you know, he is operating on a different level than I thought he was operating on. And that led to me kind of reappraising everything he had done and going back and rewatching everything. And I'm, oh, wait, okay, now I get it. Like, now suddenly Ali makes sense. So I think that, yeah, I mean, it was a very special, very important movie for me in that sense. It's still, I mean, you know, the couple of the critics I saw it with, they'll still talk about how, like, I just wouldn't stop talking about the movie on the subway ride back. Dave Fear and Josh Rothkopf were unfortunate enough to be stuck with me on the way back home from that movie. I mean, it's a very special movie, and I was just completely taken with the chemistry between Colin Farrell and Gong Li. And I still am. I mean, all these things that worked for me then still work for me. I mean, I watched this. This is probably the Michael Mann movie I've watched the most. And it's the one I, you know, as I indicated to you before we started recording, when I'm having a shitty day, there are few things that are better for me as a, like, an emotional salve than Michael Mann's 2006 film of Miami Vice, considered by some to be a, you know, a complete disaster, and considered by Mann himself to be something of a, you know, of a miss. But yeah, so that's my story.
Bilga, I'm so curious because, you know, it sounds like you were an outlier, like, at the time when you were, you know, watching the film as a critic and with other critics, and you know, what was it like? Because I've had that experience too, where I'm like, oh my God, I love this movie. And like, knowing that I'm going to be an outsider on the opinion, and like, just being like, I've got to forge ahead with this take that I have. And like, what was it like at the time when you were writing your review, or, you know, just like talking about it with the other critics? Like, I know, Blake, you've talked about your experience watching the film and people just being like, that was shit. And like, you know, coming out
what
of the theater.
What was with his facial hair? Right. He just couldn't get over his facial hair. I'm like, who cares about the facial hair?
But like, take us back to that, you know, lobby of the screening room in 2006, and like, what that experience was like for you, aside from the subway with David and Josh.
Well, it was, I didn't actually review the film. It was one of those cases where I went to the screening because I was invited and I was curious. I don't think I had to write about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's possible I wrote something, but nothing major. I still haven't written about this film. I've written about Michael Mann a million times, and I've, you know, often referenced this movie, but I've never actually done a proper piece on Miami Vice.
We know that the Criterion Collection edition of this movie is coming. Just throwing that into the universe.
And you know,
who's written a couple of Criterion essays on the show today. He could write up a Miami Vice Criterion essay. Come on.
I love the Criterion folks. They've been very good to me over the years, and I love the pieces I've had the chance to write. I never pitch them anything. I don't even know if one can pitch them anything. You know, I they will occasionally, every few months, someone will reach out and they'll be like, are you by any chance a fan of X movie? And usually it's the cases I am, or I can be. I've been very lucky in that they've always asked me about a film or a filmmaker I've been interested in. I've been very lucky in that sense. But it's never the film I expect, you know. It's never a film where I'm like, yeah, I am the guy to write about that movie. The only film I ever felt that way about that they asked me to do was was Terry Gilliam's The Fisher King.
Yes.
Which is another film I absolutely adore and have seen a million times over the years. And obviously, Terry Gilliam is someone I like a lot as a filmmaker. So when they asked me to do The Fisher King, I was like, ooh, yeah, The Fisher King. And I guess, you know, Wim Wenders' Until the End of the World also is a very special movie for me. But by and large, when they asked me to do a film, you know, my first thought is, one, I love that film. And two, huh, what an interesting choice to get me to write about that movie. So I'm not expecting to get called up to do any Michael Mann pieces. I also have this feeling that Mann is a tough one for them. I mean, they've done Thief. But I think Mann is a tough one for them because he often has so many cuts and he often has so many, you know,
Ali has three, Heat has two, Mohicans has two, Vice has two.
And he might be one of those people because Criterion loves, look, I am totally speculating, you know, if Michael Mann or Criterion is listening to this, I'm just speculating.
I allegedly
have any insight into how your minds work. But in my experience, Criterion, when it puts out a film, it wants to put out all the cuts. Yeah. Right. I mean, even Brazil, like the crappy, insane studio cut, like they put that out. And I get the sense that Michael Mann isn't one of those, let's put out every single cut of this film. I think he's one of these people. I think Ridley Scott is like that too. He's like, this is my cut, or this is my current cut, and you motherfuckers are going to put out this one. Which might be a problem Thief isn't a problem because there's only one cut of it.
Yeah.
The Insider, I suspect, wouldn't be a problem. So, you know, I feel like that could be a movie that they one day put out. Yeah, Miami Vice, not so much. You know, Ali, not so much. I'd love for them to put out Ali. Yeah, How great would that be?
That would be great. But there's three damn cuts. There's three damn cuts of Ali.
There's probably a fourth one coming. Who knows, you know?
Slip back to at the time, the only other major critic that I remember having a really positive lean into this was Manola. Manola was like all in on Vice, just like you were, and even put it in a top 10 for that year. And I just remember, if you go back to looking at it, which if you are just a sadist, if you want to be a sadist with the three of us, go back and look at your favorite movies as they are presented on Rotten Tomatoes and just see what people said about them. It is if you want to feel shitty, it's just right. One of those things to do.
It is not a thing I recommend.
It's more like I don't get, I don't feel bad about it myself. I'm like, that person's an idiot. Like, I get mad at the people. I do that now for current movies. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the one thing I did notice at the time was it wasn't so much that critics didn't get it. I think I didn't read all the reviews. I read a few. But there were a number of reviews that admired the film for a variety of reasons, but didn't necessarily think everything worked. But, you know, I remember David Edelstein was, you know, like he was basically on board with the idea, like the things that we enjoy in the film, I think he enjoyed, but, you know, he probably wanted a little more meat on the bones and stuff like that. I do remember though, it was either, you know, sometime soon after the film's release, I was talking to a friend of mine who worked for the district attorney's office, and she had just gone to see the film, and she worked with drugs, like she worked with, you know, drug trafficking, and like that was her area of expertise. And you know, I mean, she didn't know that I was a fan of the film or anything like that, but she just wanted to talk about it because, you know, I was the movie guy. And she said, you know, I really loved it, and I thought it was incredibly authentic, but I also can't imagine that anyone else could like that movie because there was so much jargon that I thought to myself, this is stuff only I understand. Like, it's like stuff that only I and like 10 other people I work with will understand. How in hell did it make its way into a Hollywood movie? So that, of course, was very reaffirming. I was like, yeah, of course, we're the smart ones, hey, you know. So it was always it was nice to hear that, and I think that also speaks to something that Mann does that is part of his modus operandi, which is, you know, the stories themselves will perhaps be a little ridiculous and the emotions will be very big, and, you know, the whole thing will be shot through with these romantic notions, and you know, the story might not always make sense, or things might jump and certain elements might not be clear, and certain things might happen a little too fast, but it's all grounded in a kind of authenticity where he makes sure that the jargon is right. He makes sure that we already know he's done his research into criminals and ex-cons and cops and undercover people. Like, this is stuff he's been, you know, obsessed with for years. So he understands certain things about this world that, you know, the ordinary filmmaker or writer might not, or audience member for that matter. And so, you know, there are these like two extremes where there's something very kind of unreal about the movie stylistically. And then there's something else about the movie that is so incredibly authentic that it's like you've been pulled into this world, and they kind of work, even though they seem contradictory, they work in tandem. Because if you were somebody who didn't understand this world, if you were an outsider and you'd been pulled into this, if you had been pulled into, you know, the salsa dancing and the, you know, the boats and all this stuff, this is kind of what your experience would be like. You would just be kind of constantly getting pulled this way and that, and thrown into situations where you weren't always entirely clear what was being said or what was being meant by, you know, these words that presumably, you know, you maybe heard but didn't understand. So I think that is something that Mann does. I think he's very conscious about that. And I think, you know, Miami Vice is kind of the ultimate expression of that. I mean, I think he does that in Black Hat too, but I think the world of Miami Vice he's much more familiar with than he is the world of Black Hat. So, you know, like hackers will, or, you know, computer nerds will look at Black Hat, and some of them will be like, yeah, he got some things right, and there are other things that don't really make sense at all. Whereas I think, like, you know, the people who kind of know the world of like undercover, you know, narcotics and stuff like that would look at Miami Vice and be like, yeah, he kind of nailed some of these elements.
I today, especially for the show, I rewatched my like unrated director's edition special features, because exactly that took, like, I just wanted to check out, because I had a vivid memory of like, there's some wild stuff that happens on this. The collateral DVD is great because it shows you that, like, he had Tom Cruise dressing up like a courier and sneaking into places and putting stickers on the back of people's shirts to signify that he killed them and all this sort of wonderful stuff. And I remember the beautiful chat that Colin Farrell had about this movie, that he basically has no vivid memories because he was at the peak of his alcoholism. So he's like, yeah, he doesn't remember. There is a moment that they got Colin Farrell into a room during what he thought was a real drug bust.
Oh, yeah.
And,
oh, yeah.
And he's in the room, and a guy says, "Are you a cop?" And Colin Farrell's reaction in the space and time with the police consultants who are actually there, who are real former undercover cops, they watched him rip his shirt open and go, "I'm not a cop," and like go, and they're like, "That was actually a pretty good move, because, you know," he said, "I'm not a cop." He just ripped his shirt open, goes, "I'm not a cop, I'm not wired, I'm not a cop." And the poor guy in these interviews is reflecting on being terrified to the point of sleeplessness that he called one of the consultants at 2 a.m. because he thought it was a real drug bust, and goes, I'm charged up, man. I don't know what to do. And then he and Michael Mann visited him the next day and was like, hey, man, you know, that was just fake. But they had no intention of telling him that it was real. And I'm like, this is the kind of shit that Michael Mann does with his cast that is kind of insane, but it's like, it just doesn't happen on other movies, and there's something about it.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. We can talk about the prank show later. Please go ahead.
No, or just that he like had Colin and Gong Li learn salsa dancing for 4 months and for like a 30-second scene. You know, like it's like the often, it's like you need to be able to like hold your own on that dance floor and look like you can, and it's not choreographed. And I mean, I also think like if you listen to the director's commentary, like he just, we've talked about this a little bit on the pod, like the authenticity and setting. I transposed this mural from Brazil, and even the stuff in Paraguay feels really like he knows, like he's studied this place. The casting feels really authentic in all of the places, you know, the diversity of the cast. I think he like really has done a ton of research on like the smallest roles of who would play these parts and who would be involved in these criminal underworlds and stuff. And then, yeah, it's funny because I was rewatching the film with subtitles on this time, with the closed captioning on, and I was picking up a lot. And like At one point when they're meeting with Jose Hierro the first time and they're posturing as to, you know, their, you know, legitimacy, like Rico, Jamie Foxx says, he's like, are you with the cops? Are you the FEEB, like the FBI? And I hadn't realized that that's what he had said until I was watching with the subtitles. And I was like, wow, that is some jargon I've never heard before, but it makes sense. There's so much detail and care put into every single element that the most, you know, casual viewer would not even pick up on. But it's important that it's there for the people who do pick up on it and for the people who are in the scene. It's like Fincher on Zodiac, like the papers that are in the drawer are like authentic.
Well, it's do I remember? I mean, it's been a while since I've listened to the director's commentary, but do I have it right? Was that like an actual trailer park they shot in?
Yes.
And it's like actual like trailer park people that are in the background of the scene.
He casts so the young man who charges Rico, Jamie Foxx's character, with a knife is cast from the trailer park, as is his mother. They're two different, they're from different families, but they were cast from the trailer park to play in that scene.
And this is also why I believe you know, the production was troubled to a certain extent, because he shot in these pretty dangerous places.
Yes.
And you know, there was like I don't remember the exact details, but there was like a shooting and there was a certain point where everybody, especially Jamie Foxx, was like, we need to get the fuck out of here and shoot the rest of this movie in Florida. And I think that's one of the reasons why Michael Mann, you know, is a little disappointed with the results of the film, because I think he had this whole climax envisioned in Ciudad del Este and wasn't able to shoot it, which makes the earlier scenes where we see Ciudad del Este kind of weirdly pointless, even though they're beautiful. But they feel like Michael Mannisms, like he just kind of threw these scenes out. But no, they were setting up the climax, right, which never happened. Although I read a draft of the script that didn't feel all that different from the finished film. So I think it was more just a sense of location rather than the actual incidents of what was happening. But that's very Michael Mann. Like, you know, the location, the mood is just as important, if not more so, than what's actually happening. So I think the fact that, you know, his big shootout and everything kind of happened in, you know, it's like some random parking lot in Miami probably a great disappointment to him.
But yeah, I mean, you take a filmmaker who is as perfectionist as Michael Mann, down to all of these details. And, you know, this is a man who like keeps cutting his films like over and over. He's like Rembrandt, you know, like he can't stop fiddling with it. But then you throw him and his production into this like utterly chaotic environment where there's like a hurricane and there's shootings and there's Colin Farrell.
It's so weird.
A chaos agent.
You're so spot on though, but he's attracted to that chaos. So that's the fusion of Michael Mann. It's like there's Justin Theroux, who is just a great character. You know, he's now like becoming in great prominence in lots of movies and shows and as a filmmaker. But he's like in this movie, he's like, you can't Google these places Michael Mann found. Like, I don't know how he found them. Like, he's in the special features going, you could never find it on Google Maps. I don't know how the hell he got us there. But we're like in this extremely dangerous spot where like police are at either barriers. There's armed guards like holding off the local populace. They do the scene. They get in. They get the hell out of there. It's like, this is a guy who's like, he also thrives on that authenticity too. So, and some of those you just can't fake. And that is also like what Burger was saying, is I would imagine that's the thing, is like, oh, I found this place, I can orchestrate this thing here. It might exactly on a map and in rehearsals have looked like this, but it's on the side of a great waterfall or it's in the chaos of that location.
Yeah. Well, and when you ask how he found it, the answer is probably, you know, some ex-con probably told me about it. You know, I mean, he loves to talk about that stuff. And I think it's mostly like, I don't think he's lying. He loves to talk to, you know, ex-cons, to cops, to prisoners and people, you know, criminals. He casts them in his movies. He'll bring them on as technical directors. And this is something that, I mean, I think he gets off on it, which, you know, who wouldn't? But I think he also loves the fact that he can use these people to achieve all sorts of things on screen that other filmmakers maybe can't. And all that is really important. I mean, just that sense of atmosphere, that sense of authenticity, as I said, you know, that is, I mean, that's the movie. That's the story. Yes. And I think one of the reasons why, you know, people don't always love some of these films is we do think of films as primarily stories often. And that's not a terrible way to think of movies, but that's the only part of the story, if you will. You know, cinema is so much more. And I think that man understands that. You know, there's a certain element of, I mean, it's not, you know, people will say, oh, it's abstract, it's like experimental. I don't think it's experimental, but I do think that there is a you know, like the texture of what you're watching is just as important as, you know, the details of, you know, this happened and this happened and this happened.
And the mood and the feeling that it creates within you. I was just thinking, because my lovely co-host here, she hosted a Q&A with Mads Mikkelsen and Thomas Vinterberg about another round. And I just, firstly, unfathomably adore that movie in every way that it can be loved. But I can't tell you, I've watched the end of that movie because it's available on Twitter almost every day to just watch the end of the movie again. And that is in a vacuum, just the way the scene makes you feel having seen it before you'd seen it, like just seeing glimpses of it and things like that in the trailers and whatnot. But like those experiences, I think of like those moods and those tones and this just like little like almost like music video clip experience summation of a movie. Like Miami Vice has so many of those, like the boat looking like a bullet through the ocean and Moby just soaring. Like you could just watch that over again. Like, you know, how fast does that go? It goes very fast. That's all I need to see of the movie that day. Like I'm done. That's it.
Right. Right.
And I think that's a whole level of how this movie like folds together in all of these huge, but also very contained sequences.
To your earlier point where the movie just sort of throws you in, like I could watch that opening every single day, like the end of another round, but, and I was like watching it today. I was like dancing around like, yes, that encore. But it throws you in. I was noticing how much I was palpably feeling the emotion of the scene. And so they just throw you into this sting that's already in progress. Obviously, theatrical cut gives you a little bit more setup for it. Or I mean, director's cut gives you more setup for it, but throws you into this thing that's already in progress. It's already moving. You don't really know what's going on. And then it throws you into the Alonzo situation, which is years long. And it's sort of the end of the Alonzo situation, obviously. But I was like so taken with how emotional that scene is with, you know, Sonny and Rico like really being so devastated by what has happened with Alonzo, with John Hawks, and how when you think about it, you're like, oh, this is like the middle slash climax of a movie that's just starting in the beginning. And as much as I, you know, did not enjoy Tenet, which tries to do the same thing.
You said one of Bilger's buzzwords, Katie.
I know. The movie is throwing you into these scenes. Obviously, when you've watched it as many times as we all have, like you understand what's going on, but the emotion is still there. The texture, the reality, the sleaziness of the bar is still there. And so you're just being thrown into this world and sort of like learning how to swim in it. But I think that's why the rewatch is so rewarding, when you're like picking up on the emotional tones and the subtext and the details and the jargon and all of this stuff. So,
well, and the thing that Mann said a couple of times when I've interviewed him, and, you know, he's talked about this other times as well, but this idea that, when he was first getting interested in film as a college student, the films that first made an impact on him were like German expressionist films and like G.W. Pabst's Joyless Street, and sort of the films from that era and around that time, which were all obsessed with the idea of perspective and the idea of how to present on screen the psychological experience of a character. Now, German expressionism did it in a way that's very different than what Michael Mann does. But that central idea, how does this feel for this character? Not just what happened and what they said and what they did, but how does this feel to be in this person's shoes? Which is, I would say, perhaps the most important thing that cinema can do. right? I mean, I think that literature can do it to a certain extent, absolutely. But I think cinema can maybe almost literally put you in another person's shoes.
Yeah.
In a way that other forms can't. Like, this is very much what man has been trying to do since the beginning of his career. Now, what's interesting is that early in his career, he achieved this through, you know, very controlled, you know, kind of pictorial, you know, new wave style filmmaking, which then sometime in the 90s, kind of becomes this very visceral, handheld, you know, expressive sort of lots of POV shots, over the shoulder shots, following people around, cutting a lot. And of course, once he discovers video, game over. But he's able to, and that's the thing he always said about why he was so taken with video, is that he could get so close to the people's faces. Like, he's, you know, trying to enter their heads, or trying to like go through the backs of their heads and see out through their eyes. And he's able to do that in this weird way by getting so close with video. And that's why I think, I mean, Collateral, obviously he does that, but I feel like Miami Vice is in many ways the pinnacle of that, of his work with video in a way. I mean, yeah. He continues to use it, obviously, but I feel like at Miami Vice, he kind of perfects it in a way, because he's working with kind of these smaller cameras. This is before high definition, you know, this is before video cameras basically become film cameras.
Yeah.
So he's kind of created this aesthetic that is like part handheld, part, you know, GoPro, part surveillance cam. And he's just cutting between all of them and creating this new language, which feels abstract on some level, but another level is incredibly immediate and incredibly like you are there, right? And then cameras get a little more sophisticated and he starts to tell slightly more traditional stories. And, you know, look, you guys know me, you know who I am. I love Public Enemies, I love Black Hat, but Miami Vice is kind of the point at which he achieves, ironically, since he's not a big fan of the movie, I feel like it's the movie where he kind of achieves everything he's trying to achieve. Right?
Well, Katie brought up the scene, the John Hawke scene. I don't know how much, we haven't covered it in like a rich amount of depth, but I think exactly what you're talking about perspectives, because there's a shot in that scene where it's like, I think this is the shot for me where I was like, and even more so than I'm encore, I'm revisiting it, is that beautiful shot that goes, it's a one shot of Colin Farrell's reaction to John Hawks, and then it's another shot to Jamie Foxx's reaction, and then it's this kind of blurred reaction, and that's where I feel like it's adopting Alonzo's perspective, and he looks over the face of Crockett and it's blurred, and he looks over the face of Tubbs and it's blurred, and he sort of stares out to those windbags, whatever they are, and the tinsel or whatever it is on the bridge, and the wind is just kicking it, and it's just like he does not recognize humanity anymore in that gaze, and then immediately just steps in traffic, and that scene is so affecting in such a powerful way. And like, as I haven't thought about it, Katie, but like, that could have been the whole movie, like what the rise and fall of Alonzo, and like,
right,
we see the summation of it as the engine of the plot of this movie, as kind of littler thread of plot we get. But that scene for me, I look at it as just a piece of expressionistic sort of cinema, and you can just see how many lessons he's learned in his career, and really I completely agree. I'm a huge fan of Public Enemies as well, but I also think it's the challenge that Fincher had to overcome with Zodiac is, how do you make these digital cameras look like film if I want it to feel like film? And Public Enemies is the chaos of like, I don't give a shit if it doesn't look like film, but I'm going to still produce this whole thing like it's a classic film. So the antithesis of the tension of the look versus the production is one of the things that kind of make it what it is. But I completely agree. There's just something, the aesthetic is so damn perfect for everything about this. And it starts in that weird yellow, like plaque colored moment on that bridge with Alonzo. It's like crazy.
I was watching Black Hat last night, and like, I was like, oh, the Hallmark Michael Mann thing is like these super foregroundy shots where it's like someone's head and, you know, super in the foreground, or a hand or something. I was like, I would be like, that's a Michael Mann movie, but like later Mann, you know, Miami Vice, Black Hat, these other movies where it's just like all these like foreground shots and it's not split diopter because like it's a digital camera. But I'm like, oh yeah, that's like the thing where I'd be like, yeah, I know. If I did not know whose movie I was watching, I would know based on these shots.
Well, the Alonzo scene, it's interesting that you bring that up because I think in some ways the Alonzo scene is a perfect summation of the thing I just discussed, which is the idea that story and incident, while important, is secondary to emotion. Because look at the way actual plot points are expressed in that scene. They're just like these fringe, little fringe things. Like, right? I mean, so he's, you know, I gotta go home. I gotta go home. Leonetta. We don't really know who she is, but we're just assuming, you know, just wife. We cut to a refrigerator, right? We don't see a face. We see an arm, and it's a man's arm. And it's, you know, there's a tiny piece of trickle of like droplets of blood on his arm. And in the background, we see, I mean, there are a couple of cuts happening here, but, you know, in the background, we see, you know, basically a pair of feet, a pair of legs on the floor. And it's just, I mean, this happens in an instant. So these elements of like, these crazy guys came in, killed your wife brutally, and now he's having orange juice out of your refrigerator. Like, this is stuff that is just like touched on just enough for us to get it. And in some cases, you know, this is the beginning of the movie and some of us are still probably getting in or sitting in our seats and, you know, buying our popcorn or not. So there are a lot of people that are just like missing all this stuff. And then, you know, and obviously when Alonzo steps into to traffic, and I mean, we know what's happened, but we see just a tiny trickle of blood. And it's like, did we imagine that? And it's like, of course we didn't imagine it. Like, this isn't like some random documentary we're watching. And yes, he did in fact step in front of the truck. So obviously there would be blood, but it's just this like tiny glimpse of it. So all these elements are just, you know, just like touched on slightly. But what's foregrounded is you look at Tubbs's face and the way he says, you don't have to go home. Mm-hmm. And then he says, they promise. And he says, they lie. I mean, that is given pride of place, and it helps to have an actor like Jamie Foxx who brings such compassion to those lines.
Oh, good.
Right.
In that scene.
We barely, I mean, at this point, I mean, look, we're in a movie called Miami Vice. Presumably we're familiar with the characters, but we barely met this guy. Right. It's, you know, like that's the movie. Like, that's the kind of movie you're about to watch. And he's setting up the language of the film. He's establishing the language of the film and preparing you for what this is going to be like. And you might want to leave if this is not your speed, you know, which some people probably did. But yeah, I mean, I think every film kind of creates its own audience to a certain extent, or every successful film creates its audience to a certain extent. But I'm a big fan of movies that sort of prime you early on for the kind of film you're going to watch. And then, you know, will surprise you in other ways, but yeah, they kind of like create their own audience.
Yeah. I think you're dead on in talking about the way that he's sort of like setting up the speed and the energy and the look and the characters and, you know, I was so taken just with that scene rewatching on this rewatch and how emotional it is. And even when you're still sort of getting your bearings with the plot or don't even have them at all, you're struck by how, you know, emotional they are.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's most important.
People will knock the romance in the movie a certain, I mean, if you don't like the movie, nothing in it probably works for you, but
right,
you know, like the shower scenes, like those are so important. The fact that
I love that today I heard a sentence that was, the shower scenes, they're so important. I just want to tell you that I love this project and you for saying that because you're not wrong. You're right.
But early on, Crockett has nobody, right? Yeah. And you know, Tubbs and Trudy have this like wonderful relationship, very kind of intimate relationship where, and then we get to see them in the shower and they're like washing each other and then having sex and being playful about it. And then later on, we get a shower scene with Colin Farrell and Gong Li, and it's like, oh, he's found, like, he's found the person that he gets to have a shower with. Like, how nice is that? You know? I mean, that's kind of like the dumb thing that you do in really, oh yeah, you know, like when you finally find somebody and you can actually like do something like that together, it's like, hey, you know, this is nice. This is nice. This is the kind of thing that you want.
You're hitting all the Miami Nice bingo cards here because all we do is talk about how much we love those sex scenes.
Yeah.
And the relationships.
And how much Michael Mann in his commentary does not even mention that one of the most beautiful and erotic and just sensual scenes is happening. He's like, yeah, so Jamie with the guns was training on a range or some. I just like, man, it's the best.
He is such a guy in that sense. I mean, he made these movies, so we know that it's important to him, but he never talks about it. You know, like he'll mention it very briefly, but it's clearly really important to him. I mean, this isn't, you know, if he just wanted to have just kind of a sex scene for the box office, there are so many other ways he could have done it.
Yeah.
You know, like, so it's not like, so it's not prurient on his end. Like, he's clearly, I mean, this is all, of course, he's so envisioned these worlds that for him, this is just a part of this world that he's envisioned. So this is as important as, you know, the scene where they're cleaning out their guns, you know, but like, that's the thing. It is as important as the scene where they're cleaning out their guns. It's like, that's actually a thing with this movie.
But I think, though, like, I appreciate that of these, like, sort of, if you want to call them like, dude, like filmmakers who make films that appreciate that, that are appreciated by men, bros being dudes, all that stuff. And I am a bro being a dude because I love these movies. But Man includes adult relationships that have sexy sex scenes that are like, but the women are equal and they're powerful. And I've seen, you know, it's in Heat, it's in a ton of his other movies. And I appreciate that so much. Like every Martin Scorsese movie, the women are terrifying and Scorsese's clearly afraid of women. And I'm not knocking him for that, but like After Hours is about how women are terrifying and like Casino, like all, there's no good sex scenes in Scorsese movies.
Yeah, this is why After Hours was like my favorite movie when I was 16 years old. yeah, that's what it's like. I'm sure that's what it's like. You know?
Obviously, there's some issues going on with women in Scorsese movies, and that's fine for me. I'm okay with that, but I really genuinely have such an appreciation for Mann having adult relationships and depicting them authentically and depicting them in a sexy way, in a romantic way, but it's not, you know, exploitative or any of the, or like, oh, we just need to get some boobs in this movie for like whatever, you know, butts and seats. It's like, no, this is how this relationship would be. And it's going to inform Tubbs's character and why he's so dedicated to saving Trudy. And that's why we need the Trudy cut, you know, with the flowers It helps us understand his motivation that much more. So I'm super appreciative of Mann's ability to at least depict relationships, if not talk about them on his director's commentary.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely, I think, part of, you know, it's absolutely part of what makes his films so special. And I mean, look, Gong Li, you know, Isabella is the only character in this movie that gets a backstory, right? I mean, there's a little bit of, you know, that bit where Colin Farrell's talking about the Allman Brothers.
You know the Allman Brothers? No, yeah, Allman Brothers.
I mean, the thing with Mann is, of course, he has a backstory for everything.
Right, right.
Yeah. Right. I mean, he has figured out everything. I mean, you know, I remember asking him about, you know, Chris Hemsworth's character in Blackhead. And he had like, he talked for 10 minutes about, you know, this guy's whole life before the movie starts. And so he has thought this stuff through, but she's the only one who gets a backstory. And it's a very touching backstory, right? I mean, it's not just like some random like backstory explaining how, you know, I mean, look, she was a last second replacement, the actress. And, you know, it's not like a backstory there to explain why there's a Chinese person in Cuba, which, you know, is not unheard of, but it's such a touching backstory. And it's, you know, it doesn't really explain anything. All it does is, you know, she talks about her mom and, you know, what an independent person her mom was and her tragic end. But, you know, it informs so much about who Isabella is, even though it doesn't tell us anything about like how she got to where she got. You know, that's really makes the film, that's another thing that makes the film really special and makes that relationship so consequential. So that at the end, I mean, the part of the climax of the film is just them sitting on a by the water for 5 minutes. And it's an amazing way to end the movie.
That's an amazing way to end the movie. This should be an amazing way for us to end this episode. Bilge Abiri, thank you so much for talking to us on Miami Nice. It literally to do this show and to not include you in some way, shape or form would have been a travesty. So thank you so much. And I always love talking to you. And it's so good to have two of my favorite people talking Miami Vice together in this beautiful trinity that we've formed where there's no room for Jesus, but there is room for us. Katie.
There's room for Bilge.
There's room for Bilge.
Can I put in a plug? Because I just read this
place.
I don't know if you guys know it. Hotel Scarface.
Oh,
where cocaine cowboys partied and plotted to control Miami by Robin Farzad. It's a great read. And it's all about basically, you know, the cocaine wars of Miami, in Miami in the 70s and 80s. Really revealing lots of stuff about Scarface, lots of stuff about Miami Vice, the production, which, you know, about halfway through the book, you know, Miami Vice comes to town to shoot. And, you know, all these drug dealers who are like hanging out at this hotel are in hog heaven because, you know, the cast and crew are coming up and, you know, they're partying with them. But it's fascinating also because, you know, you find out about the real Jose Hierro. Like there was a guy named Jose Hierro and there was a guy named Sal Maguda. And, you know, you kind of find out about the real guys and, you know, they're nothing like the characters in the movie, but they're like other characters in the movie. So it's a fascinating, anyone who's interested in this stuff, I think you would get a kick out of this book.
Getting it on the list.
Miami Nice Book Club.
That's what's next.
Yes, exactly. If I did a Criterion essay, it would be on Scarface. Sorry to interject.
Oh no, yeah. Get on that. I
know.
I'm just sitting here waiting on my hands until I'm never gonna, this is what I can safely say for us and the listeners. I'm never gonna get a call up to write a Criterion essay. But I would be deeply offended if he'd ever made its way to Criterion and no one gave me an email. That's all I'm saying. There is no one who has said more about this film than me. Ever.
You know what I would, if I ran Criterion, what I would do is I would put out Heat and then I on a separate disc with the set would be the entire One Heat Minute archive as a CD that they could just, you know, pop in because obviously everyone has CD players. So. but like I would, you know, I would find some way to get the entirety of the Blake Howard corpus on that set.
I am honestly, I watch these great movies, Miami Nice, Miami Vice after Miami Nice, Mohicans after Last 12 Minutes of Mohicans and Heat, and whenever I watch them my head is like a commentary but it has all of your voices on it. It's like if I get to a moment I'm like I get to a moment and then someone's voice comes in my head and it is quite a trippy experience because I'm no longer alone. Even if I'm watching it, I'm alone, but I'm not lonely because I have all of your voices in my head having said all of the great things that have been said. But yeah, that's my dream Criterion. So I've got no others really. Come on. They're never going to tap me on the shoulder for anything else.
It's the only one that makes sense.
It's the only one that makes sense. Thank you, Katie Walsh. Thank you, Bilge Abiri. Thank you all for listening. Bilge, any final messages before we go?
I extend my best wishes to your families.